first act as a city councilwoman? I've proposed a tax on all those giant sugary sodas so we can discourage people from drinking them. I believe with my help, all local restaurants can get healthier. Paunch Burger, Big and Wide, Fat Sack, Colonel Plump's Slop Trough, which was formerly Sue's Salads. Until we ran that out of town.
An old episode of Parks and Recreation where Leslie Knope is trying to pass a soda sales tax. While Leslie got her tax through Pawnee, Indiana City Council, she would not be able to pass one in California. Governor Jerry Brown signed a law that puts a 12-year ban on new local soda taxes. The governor also signed a sweeping bill to expand internet privacy protections, a move that could ripple out to the rest of the country. And a dozen ballot measures have now qualified for the November ballot, including separating California into three states, expanding rent control, and ending daylight saving time. Liam Dillon covers California state politics and policy for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hi.
Well, let's begin with this soda tax. It really did seem to come out of nowhere. It was first unveiled just a week ago. Now it's law. What happened?
Yeah, that's correct. So this is really what a number of lawmakers called a Sophie's choice or Hobson's choice or any other sort of bad choice metaphor, if you will. So what this was an effort to stave off a ballot measure that was sponsored by business interests and primarily financed by the beverage industry that would have made it a lot harder to raise all local government taxes. And so instead, that was pulled off. And in exchange, the beverage industry got a 12-year ban on local soda taxes.
Well, some people are saying this is basically blackmail on the part of the beverage industry, that they were saying, look, we'll pull this ballot initiative that we recognize would have broad implications for localities to pay for police and fire and all sorts of essential services if you pass this bill banning soda taxes, that just was simply blackmail.
Well, one person's blackmail is another person's leverage is another person's, like, good deal, right? I think it's important to note that this was, this was certainly a leverage play by the beverage industry, and they won. But at the same time, this is, in some ways the intent of what the 2014 law that was passed at the legislature to allow for compromise negotiations to occur on ballot measures should that ballot measures get taken off. So, yes, this is in some ways, I think you could make the argument this was extortion or whatever it is that you want to say, bad thing. But this is also sort of part of the process.
Right. OK, well, so will Berkeley, Oakland, will they be able to keep their soda taxes?
Any city in California, so there are four of them all in the Bay Area, Berkeley, San Francisco, Oakland and Albany that currently have soda taxes, they're still there. But those that went into effect this year or were proposed, like the city of Santa Cruz was attempting to put a soda tax on the November ballot, that's no longer available.
All right. Now, the other big action in Sacramento is this internet privacy bill. What would that do?
Yeah. So this was, again, another result of a ballot measure deal. There was a sort of a sweeping privacy measure proposed by a San Francisco real estate developer named Alistair McTaggart, and he agreed to withdraw his initiative in exchange for new privacy rules. And under these new rules, which are in some ways similar to kind of what happened in Europe recently, Californians have a right to know what information a business has about them, ability to prohibit companies from selling that information, ask businesses to delete that information, and also in some limited circumstances be allowed to sue over misuse of that information. So very much targeted at internet privacy.
And the tech companies hated it, but they were like, this is better than what would be on the ballot.
Correct.
What's between the two?
Yeah, and also, so the ballot measure would have been much more sweeping, particularly with respect to the ways in which companies or individuals, rather, would have been allowed to sue these tech companies. Also, it's worth noting that this was probably going to be a $100 million plus ballot measure fight. Now, while these tech companies are some of the richest organizations in the world, $100 million is nothing to sniff at, and so that money is saved for another day. I think also there's a PR situation now where it would have been a bit difficult for some of these companies, particularly those that in the past have had mottos, things like do no evil, right, to have an argument with people and tell people, we're not in support of this thing that would, add privacy protections for you, right? That's not really an easy PR argument to have, and that's what was avoided.
Okay, and this goes into effect January 1st?
2020, actually. So there was a year delay on this, and I think what that allows for, particularly because we're dealing with legislation and not an initiative, some more discussions about what might happen in this area next year.
Okay, let's talk about the ballot measures. The ballot is now set. No more measures can be added. The big ones dealing with housing, one would repeal the rule that limits rent control.
Correct.
And so that's a big one, right? Tell us about that measure.
Yeah, that's a huge one. And if this tech, particularly with this tech ballot measure off, I think the rent control one could be the most expensive one that we'll see on the ballot in November. The state has a law passed in 1995 that pretty much limits the ability of local governments to add new rent control policies in very many circumstances. This initiative would repeal that state law, and as a result, local governments could add any rent control policy they want. Certainly very much supported by tenant organizations who have been chafing under this law for many, many years, and they sort of feel, given the housing crisis in the state, that now's the right time to run a measure like this. But obviously, landlord groups disagree. They've been strong in their support of this law, and I would not be surprised if they spend upwards of $60 million or even more, potentially, to try to kill it.
Okay, and the law we're referring to is known as Costa-Hawkins. Tell us
That's
about
correct.
This other measure that would let older homeowners bring along their existing property tax rates, which are, you know, by and large, pretty low if you've lived in your house for decades, to any new home that they buy.
Yeah, this is a bit complicated, but this is sponsored by the California Realtors Association, and what they're sort of want to do is get a situation where it increases home sales in the state. Obviously, that's beneficial to them, and there is a real problem of sort of empty nesters not feeling like they can sell their property or sell their homes and move to a smaller property because they have such a great tax advantage under Proposition 13. And so what this measure would allow is, through a bit of a complicated formula, you'd be able to take some of the tax protections you have on your existing home to a new one, only if you are 55 or older, so it's restricted to more older homeowners. But you could be able to do that anywhere around the state. Now, you wouldn't be paying the lower rates that you would be having in your new house, but a blended rate between what your new taxes would have been and what this measure or what your old taxes were at your old house.
Okay, so we've talked about the gas tax repeal a lot on this show. Let's move on to the more fun ballot measures. There is one that would make daylight saving time permanent. So
it's weird. California is among many weird things in California. We have a prohibition with respect to daylight savings time. We can't change it. It's in our Constitution. And so what this would do is it would basically take that provision out of the Constitution. So there would still have to be a number of things that would have to happen before we could actually formally change our daylight savings times policies. But this would allow the legislature to do it and no longer have it in the Constitution.
Okay, and the other one would split California into three states. That probably has little chance of passing, I imagine.
It seems that way. But hey,
there
are bigger surprises have happened in elections before.
Okay, and cage-free eggs, is that a big deal? Do people really want cage-free eggs?
Eggs are, in general, delicious. I don't know. backers of this seem to think that cage-free eggs are better tasting or better, certainly better for, I don't want to make too much light of this, better for the animals that are involved. All the new rules that also apply for pigs and veal calves as well.
That they would have to be able to roam free?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Liam Dillon covers California state politics and policy for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, who is AMLO? He's expected to be the next president of Mexico. We'll find out how this leftist populist wants to take on Donald Trump next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Mexico has a presidential election this weekend, and if things go as expected, the country's new leader will be Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's a populist, he rails against the government and corporate corruption, and he is compared by his rivals to Hugo Chávez and Evo Morales. He is no fan of Donald Trump, and he gets rock star-like receptions pretty much everywhere he goes in Mexico. John Lee Anderson spent time with him during his campaign. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he joins us now. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you, Madeline?
I'm great. All right, so they call him AMLO, which are his initials. What is his appeal? What is the response amongst the voters when he goes out to campaign?
First of all, I think his appeal comes from the fact that Mexico, in the minds of many Mexicans, you know, has been failing. It's not a failed state, but the degree of corruption and violence from the drug trade and so on has depressed, you know, and demoralized, I think, Mexicans now for almost a decade. And AMLO, who's been around for many years on the left, appears at a time in which the main political parties, both of which have switched off in power for the last 70-odd years, seem to have failed their country. And he comes from the outside with the party he built himself. You know, he's kind of a Johnny Appleseed figure. He's literally trod through every village and town in Mexico for years. Everybody knows him. He flies economy class. He doesn't travel with security. People come up and touch him, take selfies with him. He kisses every woman, baby, old lady that comes without ever the slightest grimace of you know, impatience. And his discourse is quite simple. He says he's going to solve their problems. He says that he doesn't want to fail them, that he would never betray them, that he wants to be remembered by them as one of the great leaders of Mexican history, like Benito Juarez, he mentions. I think he emerges in their minds and their imagination as kind of a Lincoln figure, you know, a figure of, he's also calling for reconciliation. On the other hand, he has these schemes that which will employ the poor, will stop the young men from getting involved in the drug trade or having to come north and cross our border to work in our fields and restaurants. And in that sense, he's kind of like an FDR. And that's someone he invokes a great deal. He talks a lot about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he talks about a number of make-work schemes, both in the north along the border and in the south, where the agricultural economy has been devastated by American trade primarily, as a way of employing people again and making Mexicans feel proud of themselves, and a kind of, by no means to be mistaken with Trump's America First, a kind of hate-filled message, a kind of Mexico First. You know, if you don't want us, then we'll fend for ourselves here.
Right. The violence has been just extraordinary. I think 2017 was the most violent year on record for murders, right? More than 25,000 homicides last year?
Yeah, with almost no resolution rate. I forget what you call it, you know, when the police can actually, it's something like 5%.
When they can solve the crimes, yeah.
Exactly. So in that, you know, when you have those sort of rates, it usually means that law enforcement is involved in one way or another. And it means that, you know, murderers literally get away with murder.
What does he say about that? How is he going to fix that? And how is he going to take on the drug cartels?
You know, he doesn't have a clearly articulated policy yet. I don't think any of them do. It's a hard one. He, at one point during the campaign, he sort of blurted out that he would consider an amnesty. It wasn't clear who he was talking about, and it seemed to be a kind of a faux pas because his rivals immediately seized on it, saying, AMLO plans to let the drug traffickers go. In the, you know, wake of that, he said, no, that's not what he meant. He meant that he wanted to decriminalize the lower echelons of the drug trade, you know, the kind of mules and growers and low-level men, which you're talking about, a couple of 100,000 people. And by decriminalizing the lower rungs of the drug trade, his argument is that you can get back people in a legal economy, and with these make-work FDR-like schemes, he can employ those young men and women. As for the big guys, as for the, you know, the kind of Chapo types, the Zeta leaders and so on, it's not clear. But he says he's open to all possibilities and all suggestions. So he claims he's going to tackle it. But I think it's a kind of open book. We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, More than 120 politicians have been murdered this election season, politicians who, I suppose, said that they would also do something about the drug trade. And he doesn't travel with security. Is he in danger of being killed?
He is. I mean, you know, it's not something anybody likes to talk about too much in public, but he is. You know, I traveled with him on three different trips to the North. He travels with essentially no security, and it's very unlike the other candidates. So he, his faith is that people won't seek to kill him. And I did talk to him about this one day at breakfast, and he took it very serious. I said, do you realize when you're president that you're going to have to, you know, you're going to be, it's going to be more difficult for you to be in touch with the people. You know, I watched him walk through crowds of people for 20 minutes to get to a stage and everybody touching him. Anybody could fire a gun at him, you know. And he said, I know that it's something I worry about. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, if it means I have to choose between my security and being in contact with the people, with all of the consequences, possible consequences, I'll choose the people. And he seemed to mean it. So, you know, some of his enemies or rivals or critics might say he has a martyr complex, and indeed some do. What I see in him is a man who clearly feels he has a historic destiny. There may be an element of mystical self-faith in him. He definitely feels that he was born to lead his country, and he has that kind of slightly sainted quality of someone who I think has made the decision long ago that if necessary, he would die for his country. And one of the refrains, in answer to your question, of a lot of people that know him and know of him in Mexico is that, you know, he'll win for sure if they don't kill him first.
How big a factor is Donald Trump in this election? Because Enrique Peña Nieto, the current president, has pretty much cozied up to Donald Trump.
Absolutely. I mean, he's done, as a kind of senior diplomat told me, the only thing he hasn't done is do the Dance of the Seven Veils for him. I mean, it was a cynical but rather cuttingly true appraisal. You know, Trump is the elephant in the room in Mexico, of course. He's created a sense of crisis, not just since he became president, but since he announced his candidacy in June of 2015. You'll remember in Trump Tower, he gave that rambling announcement of his candidacy, and that was when he first mentioned Mexico as the country of the thieves and the rapists and the murderers. So It's been for nearly 3 years now that Mexicans have been in the eye of the storm, and they're now aware that, you know, the most powerful leader on planet Earth has them in his sights every single day. And it's been demeaning and it's been humiliating for them and very, very, very offensive. So naturally, this is the one issue on which all the candidates have aligned. But for some reason, even though they all say similar things, the only one who really resonates with the public as someone who feels authentic is AMLO. You know, the other politicians come out of party machinery. They're more polished politicians. He's always been the outsider, the maverick. He has a way of, with his quips and a kind of human warmth that really resonates with ordinary Mexicans. So when he says he's going to stand up for them, they believe him.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
That's John Lee Anderson. He's staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, it's called Mexico First, appears in the June 25th issue of the magazine. John, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, one of the movies out this week is situated right on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's the sequel to Sicario. We'll have a review of that movie. And on the lighter side, a Pepsi ad turned feature film, Uncle Drew.
There is so much Pepsi in this movie.
I found the product placement to be somewhat judicious, actually. They save it for the court. They save it for the end.
Oh, no. Were your eyes open during this movie?
Yes.
Okay. Movie reviews are next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Friday, time for a much needed break from all the serious and horrible news this week. Time for movie reviews with film critics Dave White and Alonzo Duralde. They both review for The Wrap and host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Gentlemen, you are a sight for sore eyes.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you for coming in today. Okay, first up, let's talk about Sicario, Day of the Soldado with Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin back for the sequel.
The president's adding drug cartels to the list of terrorist organizations.
You can understand how that will expand our ability to combat them.
You want to see this thing through? I'm going to have to get dirty.
Dirty is exactly why you're here.
You're going to help us start a war.
With who?
Everyone.
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 Why not?
Well, yeah. So aim high and aim a lot, I guess, because there's a lot of bloodshed.
Whole lot of killing going on in this
So
one.
How is the sequel?
It's not exactly a sequel in the way that we understand sequels. The story from the first film does not continue. There is no Emily Blunt. We just have the return of Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin. Directed by Italian director Stefano Sollima.
The first one is Denis Villeneuve, right?
Right. Yes, and written by Taylor Sheridan, who wrote the first one. So this one is about this bizarre situation where Mexican cartels are smuggling terrorists across the U.S. border. So the CIA sends Brolin and Del Toro in to fight dirty. And they kidnap the young daughter of a drug lord to incite war between the cartels. And it all gets very ugly.
So the idea that they'll kill each other off and we'll have peace south of the border.
And no more people coming in to blow up targets, which is the opening sequence of the film, by the way. A very target-like looking store gets blown up by Muslim terrorists who have been imported across the border by the Mexican drug cartels to destabilize the United States. Now,
Let's discuss the real-life political implications of this movie in a moment. But just your assessment, is this a good movie? Is it fun to watch?
It looks really good, and it's tense and gritty and full of killing. So people who don't think that films are all political, who just want to, you know, something to look at for 90 minutes or whatever, I guess they'll enjoy themselves not thinking about the implications of a film like this. And I get that there is one reading of this movie, that it's a film that is just about bad faith and brutal U.S. intervention, and that it's morally ambiguous and hopeless. But there's another reading of this film.
Especially now.
And if you know about U.S. intervention in Central and South America and how it goes back decades and decades and decades.
Maybe
everyone's
fueling refugee
favorite grandpa
at our
Ronald Reagan.
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Everyone's favorite grandpa Ronald Reagan was warring in El Salvador and Nicaragua back in the 80s and destabilizing everything. So you could read it as just a film about this hopelessness and corruption, but it's so on the side of the people creating that chaos that it would not shock me if you said that Fox News wrote the script.
Wow. And so was that the case with the first one?
The first one presents Emily Blunt as being somebody who actually has a moral compass and is trying to do the right thing and is undercut at every turn by the Brolin and Del Toro characters. So naturally, when it came time for a sequel, let's make it about them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe she was otherwise engaged. She had another
Mary
movie.
Poppins, which is going to make people actually happy. this is like an improv show where the audience is yelling out, terrorism, Islam, immigration, drug lords, false flag, and then here's the show.
Yeah.
It is, intentionally or not, it's a Trump movie. Mm. There's a young actress, young girl, her name is Isabella Moner. She plays the little girl who's kidnapped. Her face does all the work in this movie. She's terrified.
Yeah.
She stands in for actual human beings in this bizarre construction.
And then the billboards around town seem to be particularly ill-timed. So you have this skeleton draped with a Mexican flag and an American flag holding guns on either side. It just seems this is I don't know.
And I could not be more grateful for the fact that most of those billboards are being tagged and defaced.
Okay, let's move on. Next up, Leave No Trace, starring Ben Foster and Thomasin McKenzie.
You alone out here?
My daughter's with me.
Dad?
Let's go.
Can you tell me where you live? In the park?
There's 435 questions. Respond true or false to each question.
Who taught you how to read?
My dad teaches me.
Okay, this is about a veteran and his 13-year-old daughter living out in the woods in the boonies, and then they get discovered and they're brought in by social services and they try to make it in the real world. Doesn't work out so well for them, Alonzo.
Right. Yeah. So the, you know, clearly he's a veteran who is suffering from some level of PTSD, wants to live off the grid, you know, and he and his daughter
way
off the grid. And he and his daughter do have like, you know, these sort of systems of, you know, how they collect water and how they get food and, you know, where they make their money and all that stuff. But yeah, they are discovered. They are kind of brought in and then they're placed in a house and it seems like it might be the right thing. But he's, you know, he goes to work at a Christmas tree farm, and these trees are brought in by the loads from the forest by helicopters. And just on Ben Foster's face, you can see what the sound of a helicopter is doing to him. And then meanwhile, his daughter, who is devoted to him and loves their life, starts meeting other people and like making friends her own age. And there's a tug of war there. And so eventually
sleeping in a bed.
Yes.
Having a roof. Yeah.
So they, you know, eventually he wants them to take off again. They seem to find an enclave that might allow for the best of both of what they want. But it's a question of, you know, are they ready for that?
Mm-hmm.
And Deborah Granick directed and co-wrote, it's based on a novel called My Abandonment. She discovered Jennifer Lawrence with Winter's Bone. She launched Vera Farmiga's career with To the Bone, which won the LA Film Critics Best Actress Award. And Granick just is a very intuitive director. This is not a movie with a lot of speeches where people explain to you how they feel or how they got here. It's all in the faces. And I would not be surprised if Thomasin McKenzie gets the kind of boost out of this film that those previous two actresses did, because she's great. She's wise but naive, and she's, you know, fragile but resilient. And I was reminded of like Olivia de Havilland or something, looking at her. And this movie just broke my heart. But it's so beautifully told. There's a lot of non-professional actors in it, but also like Dale Dickey pops up as an important character toward the end. I've admired Ben Foster for decades. I really want to see him do a comedy because he's so intense all the time. It just it's like, I want to just breathe, Ben Foster. You're
and
great.
This movie, though, as you say, it does break your heart, but it is not an overwhelmingly sad movie. I mean, because the people in it are pretty much nice people.
Yeah, no, it's
nothing
it,
bad.
There's no villain here. Even the social services people mean well and are trying to do the best by these two people. It's not like they come up against this horrible, faceless bureaucracy or whatever. It's just these two have to kind of get over what's going on inside of them, and it's never sentimental, but it's incredibly moving.
Hmm.
Very much like Sicario, it is a movie about right now. And it's about people falling through the cracks, and it's about how trauma affects family life and what happens when there's a child who's coming of age who needs something else and who's understanding that the way I've been raised, even though my father loves me, this isn't sustainable for a long period of time. So it's very gentle, beautiful filmmaking, places you in the lives of these characters right away and stays there.
Yeah.
I cannot recommend it highly enough.
And it's certainly about the fact that we, you know, we send people off to war for reasons that can be debated and then don't take care of them when they come home. And that's a national disgrace. And that's really the undercurrent of this film. And again, there's never speeches about it, but it's all there. You see it unfold.
Yeah. And also I like how you really understand the people behind the people we are seeing everywhere now in tent encampments, living on the margins, homeless people. And these are real people. They're not just cardboard cutouts.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, let's switch gears now to a comedy. It's called Uncle Drew. Real-life basketball player Kyrie Irving is Uncle Drew. He's got a lot of makeup on.
Lots.
Also stars Tiffany Haddish, Lil Rel Howery from Get Out, and Shaq. No.
Was you just watching me sleep again?
Boy, you are better than cable, okay?
Wait a minute now. What's going on?
I used everything I got on this tournament.
You lost our superstar to another coach.
What's that smell? Is that a grudge?
Okay, what's going on here? This was from a Pepsi ad, right? This movie came from an ad.
You loved the commercial,
yes.
And now...
Listen, they made a movie about emojis, so...
All bets are off.
You can make a movie about a Pepsi commercial now, and it's fine.
Fine?
It is. It's fine, if you want to make a movie about a Pepsi commercial.
Okay.
Dax is the name of the character. That's Lil Rel Howery. He's coaches a Rucker Park basketball team. Now, Rucker Park is a legendary basketball court in Harlem. The NBA legacy of this court is deep. So many people who played on that court when they were young became NBA stars, like Wilt Chamberlain.
Huh.
It also, a little fun fact, stood in for Oakland in Black Panther, the basketball court at the beginning and the end of the film.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's
Thanks
Rucker
for
Park.
That fun fact.
So anyway, he coaches a team that abandons him for a bigger, better deal. So he has to go recruit legendary Rucker Park player Uncle Drew, Kyrie Irving,
He's supposed to be old, but the makeup, he doesn't seem old at all.
Uncle Drew and his team were supposed to have played 50 years ago and then didn't show up for the finals. And so he's got to get the band back
together. So they go on a road trip in a big orange van from the 1970s with an A-track player, and they collect all these old guys who are played by actual basketball players between the ages of 25 and 50.
But are they just making the makeup look bad on purpose?
It is weird.
So that you're
good
in on the
question.
Joke, or...
It is so
I'm sure
funny.
They'll say, if you ask that, they'll say, oh, of course, it was intentionally terrible.
Well, let me talk about who the basketball players are. It's Kyrie Irving, Shaquille O'Neal, Chris Webber, Reggie Miller, Nate Robinson, and WNBA star Lisa Leslie.
Oh, cool.
And so the makeup in this movie, over the end credits, you see the makeup being applied to everyone. It's just a mountain
with a
mountain of latex on everyone's head.
Right.
They're in the chairs, you know, for hours and hours to be transformed into the weirdest, uncanny valley looking old people that you have ever
but
seen.
I love how they don't even try to shuffle or move like an old person. They kind of stride across
a little
the basketball.
Until
when they're not dunking or participating in a dance-off, they are moving like fake old people. And I think this was an intentional move. I think the whole point of the film from start to finish is, hey, check out Kyrie Irving in that weird makeup.
Yeah.
I honestly believe that's part of the joke here. And it's such a weird movie, and it steadfastly refuses to be anything else.
I was not as into it as Dave was.
Is it funny?
Periodically.
It is sometimes funny. Sometimes it doesn't seem to care if it's all that funny. The sports movie elements are so corny and good-hearted and sweet that by the end of it, when they're doing the let's all pull together team, I was moved. I felt like, yay, go team, go Uncle Drew.
Because you know what's going to happen. He's going to out-dunk the youngins.
It's adorable. Right? Yeah. And I got to say something else. Shaq is really funny in this
movie. Shaq is funny in this.
Well, Shaq
is
funny in general.
Very funny.
Yeah.
There are some moments that are treats, and like, you know, Tiffany Haddish, always want to see her do her thing. But yeah, there are just these sort of stretches where it's like, okay, I'm kind of bored now. Like, can we get on to the big game, please? Because I'm not interested in all this other stuff that they're cramming into the movie.
Does it make you want to drink a Pepsi?
Not for lack of trying. There is so much Pepsi in this movie.
I found the product placement to be somewhat judicious, actually. They save it for the court. They save it for the end.
Oh, no. Were your eyes open during this movie?
Yes.
There were so many Pepsi machines in the background, like hospital.
There were Pepsi machines.
There's Pepsi machines all over this
Those are diegetic Pepsi machines. That's how real life is. There's always a Pepsi machine around.
Yeah.
So it's as convincing as the makeup.
Basically, yeah. You're meant to notice it either way.
Dave White, Alonzo Duralde, they both review for The Wrap and host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Coming up, three identical strangers, triplets, who were adopted into separate families and then found each other when they were 19. A new documentary follows them after that and finds a complicated, tragic story about how these brothers were the subjects of a secret experiment. Next on Press Play. The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When Bobby Schaffran was 19 years old and showed up at college for the first time in 1980, he received an unusual reception from the other students on campus.
Girls were kissing me, like fully kissing me, saying, "I'm so glad you came back." And I was saying thank you and hello back, but I had never been there before and I didn't know them. It was bizarre. And the next thing I heard from right behind me, "Welcome back, Eddie."
Eddie was a student there the year before. Bobby looked exactly like Eddie.
He had the same grin, the same hair, the same expressions. It was his double.
Bobby and Eddie figured out pretty quickly that they were twins, separated at birth and adopted by two different families. Well, Newsday picked up the story, and when the paper ran a photo of the twins, another young man saw it and recognized himself in the photo. He was their third brother. So, triplets, separated for 19 years. A new documentary tells their story. It's called Three Identical Strangers, and it's directed by Tim Wardle, who joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
So the third teenager, David, sees the photo of the twins, gets in touch. What happens next?
The boys find each other, the three brothers, and instantly become overnight celebrities. You know, they go on every news show, every talk show, and the world wants to hear about their story.
Eddie and Robert and David reunited after 19 years.
We have a story about triplets that gives new meaning to the phrase long-lost brothers.
We went on everything.
They're living it up after that. They're going to parties, Studio 54, having a grand old time in the 80s in New York.
Yeah, they found each other at the age of 19. They're in New York. You know, New York's just developing into this kind of hotspot of culture, music, and they're just right at the center of it.
And did they feel an instant affinity for each other when they first met?
Yeah, I think they all talk about the fact that actually before they met, they felt that something was missing in their lives. And actually, two of their parents remembered two of the boys waking up from sleep saying, I have a brother, or I have at least one brother, you know, and thinking that was just the kid having a strange dream. Huh. So as soon as they met, they instantly bonded. And one of their aunts, who was present when they first met, talks about them rolling around on the floor like puppies the first moment they meet. So it was an instant connection.
And it's really remarkable how alike they look. They even have the same haircuts.
Yeah, although I think that they also sort of wanted to look alike as well. So they did look very similar the first time they met, but they've sort of then started mirroring each other even more and dressing alike.
You mean for their media appearances?
I don't think it is even their media appearances. I think they genuinely wanted to be very similar, be alike, because they'd grown up in these different families and they knew they were adopted, and suddenly they found they had a blood relative and they just wanted to be exactly that person.
And what kinds of families adopted them? What were they like? I know they were all in the same general area, right, in the New York metropolitan area, but they were of different backgrounds, right?
Yeah, they were all Jewish families in the New York area, but, you know, one family was very wealthy. Then another family was sort of more middle class. The parents were teachers. And David's family, who was the last triplet to find the boys, they were kind of much more blue collar, kind of working family. You know, they were immigrants from Austria and English wasn't their first language. So you really had a kind of the full socioeconomic kind of spread of families.
And the parents didn't know about the siblings?
No, absolutely not. The parents all adopted the boys and were told when they adopted from the same adoption agency that there was just one child. They were told nothing about the existence of brothers.
Okay, so tell us about this adoption agency. It's called Louise Wise Services.
That's right, yes. Louise Wise Services was the kind of premier adoption agency in New York at the time, particularly for Jewish families. It was very exclusive.
And so at the time, this is 1961, was it the practice that they would split up twins or triplets and give them to different families?
Well, I mean, that's one of the questions that the film asks. You know, I mean, I think that it certainly wasn't standard practice for most adoption agencies, and this agency at one point started doing it, and that's part of the story of the film.
Okay, so spoilers coming up. So let's discuss a little bit about that part of the movie, because you know, the first part is super dramatic and incredible with the reunion and how they get together and learn about each other and become close brothers. But then there's a darker side. It turns when you start to investigate exactly what this adoption agency was doing. And it turns out that the agency was actually studying these kids.
Yeah, the agency was working with a psychiatrist called Dr. Peter Neubauer, who was a prominent psychiatrist in New York and actually, well, across America, to split up identical siblings and then put them in different families and then study them.
And tell us more about Dr. Neubauer.
So Neubauer was a refugee from Austria, but from the Holocaust.
Jewish.
Jewish, set up in New York and became, I mean, I've heard him referred to as the father of child psychiatry in America. I mean, he's a hugely influential figure.
And he was a Freudian?
Yep. He's, you know, Freudian by training and had a close relationship with Freud's daughter, Anna Freud.
And so he decides that he wants to study twins or, in this case, triplets.
Well, I think what happened, you know, it's a very interesting period in the 50s and 60s for psychology where this, you know, it's trying to establish itself. Psychology is a new science. And there are a lot of people doing experiments and studies that by today's standards, we wouldn't consider ethical. You know, things like the Stanley Milgram obedience experiments and later Stanford prison experiments. So there was a lot of things going on. But I think Neubauer, what he wanted to do with this study, we believe, and there's a lot of secrecy still around it, what we believe he wanted to do was look at the nature-nurture question and try and essentially solve it by taking people who are genetically identical clones of each other, which is what identical siblings are, and place them with very different families and see how they turned out differently or whether they would turn out the same in completely different environments.
Okay, so these three, they find out that they were part of an experiment and they remember as children being studied. Here is David as an adult and what he had to say about that.
You're talking about a group of people that went and held a baby and did psychological testing on a six-month-old baby and then went to another house to see his brother and then went to another house to see his brother and did this over years and years and years and years with full knowledge that we were within a 100-mile radius and not knowing each other. It's just, it's unconscionable.
So understandably upset, all of the brothers and the families were extremely upset to learn this. And the researchers, did they not think that they were doing anything unethical at the time?
Just to go back just very quickly, just that I think it's important to explain that the families, the adoptive families, obviously knew that scientists were coming to the house to study their adopted child, but they were just told that this child was taking part in a normal child development study, and it was actually one of the sort of conditions, or it was implied that it was one of the conditions of the adoption. So mm-hmm. They had no idea that it was part of this wider scheme to study nature nurture with other identical siblings placed elsewhere. They had no idea. The researchers, it's a very good question about how much they knew and how, and you know, it's a question that the film looks at, how much they knew that the study was unethical. I mean, I think that it is important that we take into account the context of the time, as I mentioned, the 50s and 60s, where it was kind of the Wild West of psychology and these kind of a lot of crazy experiments were being done. But I also think that certainly the people who set up the study, I think they did know that even by the standards of the time that it was somewhat unethical. They tried to approach various other adoption agencies apart from Louise Wise Services for subjects for this study and were told, no, you can't split children up. You can't split siblings up. That's just wrong.
And it's wrong because, I mean, ethically speaking, obviously it just shocks the conscience that you wouldn't know that you have a sibling out there and you didn't get to grow up with that sibling.
I think just the, you know, it just feels on some kind of basic human level, it feels wrong that, you know, siblings and these are, we know now that babies in the womb, you know, they interact. If they're twins and triplets, they've been pictured, you know, kissing each other and playing with each other in the womb. And then, you know, the boys and the other people involved in the study, because it wasn't just the triplets, they were split up when they're about 6 months old, so they've been in a crib with their siblings for a long time. And actually the film looks at the fact that a lot of them displayed really disturbed behaviour after they were first separated, and they'd be rocking in cots on their own or banging their heads against the wall.
So this is a Jewish Holocaust survivor, and his assistants also Jewish, or many of them, studying Jewish families in this way. Not that long after the Holocaust, like 20, 30 years after. So, well, first I just want to play a clip of tape from David's aunt, Hetty, about that.
Coming from the Holocaust, our family has a knowledge of that when you play with humans, you do something very wrong. And I really believe that because of this research, these three boys did not have happy endings.
So we won't give away the endings, but what about that ethical conundrum of Jewish Holocaust survivors doing this to other Jewish children?
I mean, I think it's a central irony of the film that Dr. Neubauer came from Austria, as you say, a Holocaust survivor, and as did David, one of the triplets family. They both fled Austria and they ended up on either side of this experiment. I wanted this story to seem universal, so I didn't want to sort of dwell on it too much, but it's obviously important to acknowledge it. I'm not Jewish, but my wife is Jewish and finds this aspect of it incredibly troubling. You know, the idea that, as you say, so close to the Holocaust, Jewish people would inflict these experiments on other people. I think, again, the context of the time is important to mention, and the fact that, you know, these people who were running these experiments, I don't think they were like bad or evil people. You know, what's fascinating is they were good people who did a really bad thing. And one of the journalists who appears in the film, Lawrence Wright, he has this phrase called noble cause corruption, which he uses to kind of discuss why good people do bad things sometimes. And I think for me as a filmmaker, that's what I'm interested in, those kind of gray areas of human behavior.
But it does seem that they knew that what they did wouldn't at least be accepted, because they didn't publish the study and they put it pretty much under lock and key for decades.
I think that's right. I mean, when the triplets were reunited, people started looking into how could this have happened? And I think the scientists knew that times were changing and this information was not going to be well received by the public. So the study was buried, essentially. It was locked away at Yale University until 2066, when anyone associated with the study would be long since dead.
Hmm. And so were they ever able to prove? I guess we won't know until 2066 or when people can analyze it, but whether or not they settled the nature-nurture question?
I don't think they did. I mean, I think it's still a question that's ongoing to this day. They found some really compelling research. I mean, I've seen some of the study notes, which the triplets have managed to get released, which suggests some striking similarities between them, despite the fact they were growing up in different homes. But as you'll know if you've seen the movie, and when you do see the movie, the boys ended up with very different lives. And if nature was everything, if genetics was everything, they should have ended up very, very similar.
Hmm. It's a fascinating movie, really well done. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's director Tim Wardle. His new film is called Three Identical Strangers. A final word today about the shooting at the Capital Gazette in Maryland. Five people were killed, four journalists and a woman who worked in sales. And I've been spending a lot of time on that website reading the work of these journalists, including one from Rob Hyacin, a column there. I wanted to read a little bit from that column. It's called The End of an Unsentimental Journey. He begins, "Have you ever lost a loved one you haven't loved in 40 years? She kept me company until she left. Hers was an unsentimental and durable leaving." He's talking about a girlfriend that he had in high school who dumped him. He says there were no post-breakup meetings, no chances for reconciliation. Boy loses girl, period. Sometimes you just know when love is done. She knew. And then he goes on to talk about his hopes for what her life was like. He says, "I hope she was more happy than sad. I hope she had children, not because everyone needs to, but because I have three wonderful kids. I hope she found rewarding work. I hope she forgot all the old person music I subjected her to during the late 1970s. I hope she knew three or four great dogs. No, I don't hope she remembered me fondly. It's all right if she didn't truly, but I remember her with fondness, gratitude, and a glancing, renewed loss. Goodbye to the girl who knew how to say goodbye. That was a column Rob Hiasen wrote 7 months ago. If you want to read that or any of the writing of the other journalists who were killed yesterday, go to the Capital Gazette website. And that's it for me. I'll be out next week on vacation, and Barbara Bogave will be here. Have a great weekend.